So about 6 months into the pandemic, this lady signed up for a perfume subscription. So apparently it's where you get three perfume samplers every month for $19. She says she did it just to create some extra stimulation for her senses in lockdown, and maybe just to get a nice surprise in the mail every month. So one day she put on something called Juliet Has a Gun, which has the things she liked, jasmine, cotton flower, and white musk. Except she was disappointed, because after putting it on, she found that it didn't smell like anything. Then she realized, actually, she caught COVID and lost her sense of smell. So she wrote an article about it, which included the story of a chef who lost her sense of smell in a car accident. It was devastating, she said. All the nuances of flavor, all the details were gone. Not being able to smell and taste, she was forced to change career. Sometimes she said she would notice an earthy, gardeny smell everywhere she went, but it turned out to be just a phantom smell in her head. But then one day, she smelled rosemary and then garbage in New York City in the summer. It was very exciting, she said. I could smell it. All of our life experiences are stored and cataloged in our souls by sights and sounds and smells and tastes and feelings. And these are our memories of being alive, because God made us to experience life with our five senses. To this day, the aroma of McDonald's food reminds me of a 50-year-old memory of my family picnicking on Burnaby Mountain Park whenever there was a 25-cent burger sale. What scent or taste or sensations are in your favorite memories that instantly make you think of your childhood home or just make you happy? What makes these experiences of life possible? It's our bodies. So what would life feel like, do you think, when the inevitable moment comes and our soul leaves our bodies behind, we die, and we're released into the universe's energy? What will life after death feel like when we don't have our bodies to experience life with? It's hard to imagine, right? Well, what happens to us after we die is the thing Paul is reviewing in chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians. So this is the letter that Paul writes in reply to the one he got from them that made him mad. Apparently, one of the things they bragged to Paul about was that they were now too spiritually mature and too sophisticated to believe in something as silly as resurrection. So Paul is probably quoting them back to them when he writes in verse 35, how are the dead raised? What kind of body are we getting? They've been arguing about it. And because of the lack of detailed explanations and because they could not imagine it, they decide to write it off as fantasy. Well, if only someone on the other side could send us a message back, right? Because Shakespeare says death is the country from which no traveler returns. I've been watching this old British TV show. So this widow has been getting messages through a medium from her late husband. The daughter was sure that the mother was being scammed, so she hired a detective to go and suss out the medium. The mother told the detective, oh, I figured out she was a fake a long time ago. I mean, my husband kept saying how happy he was at the other place. I mean, my husband complained about everything in life. This was a man who would find fault with the workmanship of the pearly gates. The Christians in Corinth, probably the more well-to-do people, having rejected resurrection as science fiction, decided that instead of investing in eternity, they would just rather live it up now. So verse 32 might have been them quoting Isaiah 53:13 to Paul's face a bit out of context. Let us eat, drink, for tomorrow we die. See, is biblical, they claim. Their thinking was, since this life is all we get, then let's extract every bit of pleasure we can while we can so we don't miss out. Just live life to the hilt now. Use every inch of the body to extract every pleasure life has to offer. Use it up like a disposable tissue it is, then chuck it and be released to the stars. And so possibly this is at the root of all the other relationship problems in this church. That people in their hurry to live as large as possible before they die, they were not being careful with their own bodies and health, and they were harsh and impatient and short-tempered with each other because there are things to do, places to go before time runs out. So it seems what we believe about what happens to us after we die affects how we live before we die and how we treat people. It wouldn't come as a surprise to us that according to the latest American poll during COVID, that 97% of atheists don't believe there's an afterlife, and 92% of Christians do. But for Paul, the good news of resurrection is not just whether we believe we live on after we die, it's how we live on that makes a good news. But unfortunately, even Christians have misconceptions about what resurrection is really about. And it's not our souls being released from this life and our bodies to live in bliss somewhere else for eternity. N.T. Wright tells a story of attending his godson's funeral. This young man was just in his 30s when he died of cancer. The service, he says, is deeply Christian. Hundreds of people there who came to mourn this young man who had touched their lives. They sang vibrant hymns. The sermon was wise and consoling. And the young widow gave a funny, poignant tribute. But there was one note missing, he said. And he wrote this. The word resurrection itself came in the liturgy right at the start when the minister recited Jesus' saying in John 11, I'm the resurrection and the life. That was repeated near the end with no explanation. But the whole of the rest of the service could have been summarized in the following passage from a well-known first century writer. All of us are sojourners here and strangers and exiles. The soul is an exile and a wanderer which has left heaven for earth and life on earth as on an island, buffeted by the seas, imprisoned within the body like an oyster in a shell. The writer goes on to speak of Socrates, others who were happy to depart this life for a blissful heaven. Here's the problem. This is not what Christianity means when we talk about resurrection. Yes, Christians believe life goes on after we die, but other religions believe in a sort of life after death. And just living on after we die is not why resurrection is good news, especially if this life had been a hard slog for us. So Paul begins his review on resurrection, calling the Corinthians foolish in verse 36. Christianity is not good news without the promise of resurrection, because if resurrection is impossible, then Jesus could not have been raised from the dead either, and human beings still live under the curse of death. And if Jesus was not raised from the dead, then we're all liars or delusional, wasting our lives living and defending and preaching a made-up thing. And if that's not true, then how sad for us, Paul says, throwing our lives away to follow Jesus for nothing. Christianity is not good news without resurrection, and Jesus is just some guy if there was no resurrection. Paul says in Romans 1:3 that Jesus proved he was really the Son of God by his resurrection from the dead. The British historian Tom Holland was in an interview about his book on how Christianity changed history, and he was explaining why Jesus dying on the cross was so important to Christian theology when the interviewer interjected, "So the crucifixion is what changed history." "No," Tom corrected him, "it's his resurrection that changed everything." What makes resurrection really good news and our life to come something worth looking forward to is what the eyewitnesses tell us about their encounters with Jesus' resurrection body Just ask them, Paul tells the Corinthians in verse 6. Some of them are still alive to bear witness. So what makes resurrection good news, and the thing all of Christianity hangs on, is that Jesus was raised from the dead with a new resurrection body that can feel and be felt. Jesus was the first person to get this new body, and like the first crop of a harvest, Paul says in verse 2, the first fruit is how a farmer tells and predicts the size and quality of the harvest to come. The joy that his disciples experienced meeting the risen Jesus was a taste of what we will experience when we together will get our resurrection bodies together. So Paul illustrates resurrection with the picture of a seed, beginning in verse 38. Have you seen a seed for a cedar tree? I had to Google it. It's about the size of a coffee bean. I think if I told a kid that 500-year-old cedar in Tofino that we can't even wrap our arms around came from the inside of that seed the size of a coffee bean, the kid might not believe me. Not right away. So Paul's first point is that even though the seed looks very different than the tree, there's a sort of genetic link between the seed and the tree. Something of that seed is the same something in that tree. So our resurrection body will be as different as a humble seed to the 500-year-old majestic cedar tree at Tofino it grows into. But there's also continuity. That something genetic of us, that essential bits of who we are, will be transferred to the inside of our resurrection bodies. This was why when Mary Magdalene saw the risen Jesus at the tomb on Easter Sunday, she thought he was the gardener. Something about Jesus didn't look like Jesus at first. But then, of course, she wasn't expecting to see Jesus when she saw him die. But then as she talked with the stranger, she felt a familiarity. Then she recognized it was Jesus. So all the ways God's Spirit is growing and transforming our souls now, this is God preparing our insides for our resurrection bodies, like upgrading software to go with the new hardware. What we're becoming, what we are to each other, we will carry on into that new body into eternity. So continuity means resurrection is more than just what happens to you or me individually after our bodies die. It's also about us being friends for eternity. That God is building and raising up a new family of his. We have new life in new community beginning now so we can bring our friendships into eternity. And that's why Paul's encouragement to a church mired in conflict includes a review on resurrection. We're in this resurrection thing together. There'll be continuity between our current bodies and our resurrection bodies, but they will also be different because God designed different bodies for different habitats. The body of a fish is not the body of a bird. So Paul says in verse 44 that our natural body, the ones we're born with, the one that wears out and runs down and bogs us down with illnesses, this natural body is not designed for life in eternity. For that, we need new hardware, what Paul calls a new spiritual body, not in the sense that it's a spirit without a body, but in the sense that Jesus says in John 3:5 that we are the children of God. We, as the children of God, are reborn of water and the Spirit. So carrying on with the seed analogy, Paul says in verse 37 that for that seed to grow into that tree, the seed has to die into the ground in a poetic sense. But Paul emphasizes that God did not create humans to die. Death is the result of a broken creation, a derailment from God's original intentions. That's why in verse 26, Paul says death is the enemy to God's creation, and resurrection, Jesus's first and then ours, is God's definitive victory over death. So we still die in this body, but instead of death being the end of us, it's now our transition into the beginning of resurrection life. In Western culture, death is definitely the enemy to life. I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that people in the Western world wish to live forever. I saw this interview with a doctor who does longevity research. This is a man in his 60s who easily can pass for 40-year-old. And he says with a kind of bravado that his research shows that we don't need to see death as inevitable, but a disease that can be treated, he says. There's no reason why we have to die anymore. Really? Do you believe him? Recently, there was a news story from a guy who's been studying trout in the Great Lakes since the 60s. And he discovered that the DNA samples from old fish over the past decades have the same genetic age as young fish. So maybe it's true that our bodies don't have to age and deteriorate if we can only just get the fish to fess up what they're doing to stay young and fit. And this is just the kind of good news that wealthy people in the West want to hear. People who are willing to pay anything, do anything to stay young forever and not die. Some people are paying for the bodies to be frozen so they can be brought back to life if and when scientists figure out how to do that. And there's a company that's working on uploading our consciousness into the cloud so we can live on. But of course, these are only options for people who can afford it. And people who have been blessed, I guess, with such a good quality of life that they would do anything and pay anything to keep living on, because only for them is death a threat, and they have no need to look forward to something better. Well, COVID certainly has thrown a wrench into our notions of invincibility. Every day, we're reminded we're still frail mortals, vulnerable to many things that we don't even realize existed. In Paul's world, life in the empire was such a chore that most people, even for the wealthy, actually look forward to dying as an escape from this hard life. And this is probably the problem that the Corinthians have with resurrection. Epictetus was a Greek Stoic philosopher who lived around Paul's time. He was born into slavery in Turkey and was sold to one of Nero's secretaries. He had some sort of disability in his legs, which was either he was born with or was a life-altering injury from a severe beating by his master. But he became interested in philosophy and got permission from his master to study. So he was eventually granted freedom to become a teacher, and his writings would go on to educate Roman men, including the emperor Marcus Aurelius. And what he taught was that death was not a bad thing, but a good motivator to living well. And he would say, what harm is it? Just when you're kissing your little child to say, tomorrow you will die? Wow, talk about reality check. But for a kid, it's why some people think he was a jerk. Maybe he got that way because his life was so tough. But he wasn't alone. Most Romans saw death as a release from the pain and suffering of life and from being weighed down with this failing body. Why would anybody want to come back to suffer more of this life anyways, they would say? And to make matters worse, resurrection was unthinkable because they thought it was a rotting corpse coming back to life like a zombie. So the idea of it was just sort of disgusting. Plato did think there was some sort of afterlife of the soul, but it's not a happy place. So some of the pagan religious rituals like sacrifices and being baptized in the blood of a bull were attempts to make life better for dead relatives. It's not unlike the Chinese at funerals, burning paper money and paper cars and paper mansions so that the loved one would have what they needed to live well in the netherworld. The majority of Jewish people in Paul's time did believe in a sort of afterlife and thought death as a kindness because life was hard. So they look forward to being raised from the dead when the Messiah comes. And it's like Lazarus getting his old body reanimated, or the dry bones in Ezekiel coming back to life. And that's why the Jewish people have these bone boxes. After a body has been placed in a cave, they were very careful about coming back after a time to collect the bones and rebury the box. But then in the Roman world, human remains were cremated So the rabbis argued about exactly how much bone was needed for successful reanimation. So in the meantime, between death and reanimation, Jewish people talked about Sheol. It's a waiting place of mourning and grieving for the tragedies people have suffered in life. But for the faith heroes like Abraham, they hoped there might be a happier place for them to wait for reanimation. Now, across the other side of Paul's world, Hindus and Buddhists believed in reincarnation rather than resurrection. That after death, their souls get a memory wipe and are reborn into the world from scratch for another go around. But since Buddha thought life painful, full of suffering, he taught that the ultimate goal of a Buddhist was to do enough good things in this life to earn enough points to break out of the endless cycle of drudgery in the world, to reach a saintly state so that they would be exempt from having to come back again. Well, these are all the different ideas about what happens to people after death. And what Paul reminds the Christians in Corinth is that none of these are very good news for people created by God to live an abundant life. And the resurrection God promises us, resurrection that all of Christianity hangs on, is much better news than any of these ideas. Because besides continuity, besides the defeat of death, what we know from Jesus' first fruit resurrection is that we will one day be back in a body like ours, but better, just like the one Jesus got. A body that could feel Thomas touching his nail wounds and tasted fish that Jesus had with Peter for breakfast. And I imagine eyes that welled up when he asked Peter if he loved him. And Peter said, "You know I do." The Greek philosophers thought human bodies were made of garbage. But Genesis insists that every cell that makes up the universe and us are purposefully and beautifully made, which God declared as good when he made them. And God's specification for human beings is the gift of a body for our souls to live and experience life with. And resurrection is God restoring us to his original specification, so we would not be souls floating in space, but our souls housed in a new and better body. And that's good news. Because without a body, we have no way to feel and live life. The hope in Christianity is not about escaping this life to a better life someplace else, as disembodied spirits living in bliss. But as what N.T. Wright's call life after the life after death. That after our body dies physically, we continue to live on for a while without a body. This is life after death. But this is not the whole thing. Our ultimate hope is actually to get into our resurrection bodies and live on and continue to experience life and gain new experiences. This is the life that is after the life after death. And that is our ultimate hope of resurrection as Christians. And resurrection is bigger than just what happens to people after we die. Ronald Rollheiser writes, "Christ did not come just to save human beings. He came to save the earth as well." Resurrection is about God restoring a broken creation and setting it back on its proper course. Is God undoing the damage done by our first ancestors, Adam and Eve, when they chose to leave the Garden of Eden and instead to make life happen for themselves out in the wilderness, and all the subsequent decisions that broke creation with injustice and violence and pain and suffering? And that's how the Jewish people came to see death as a kindness, so humans would not have to suffer the cruelties of life forever. But God didn't give up on us, or settle for us living short, limited lives, or wander the cosmos as disembodied spirits for eternity. Instead, a plan was hatched for Jesus to come and rescue creation so that one day we can get back the life God intended for us when he made everything, which is us with a new body that is no longer broken, no longer wears out, or can be invaded by viruses. so we can go on and hug and eat ice cream and smell roses and take in the colors of Monet's water lilies and be thrilled by the way Mozart's concertos move the air around in our ear. This is our resurrection hope for of life for the world to come, life after the life after death. So, have you thought about the things you will want to do when you get your new body? I had a cousin who died when we were kids. I think about him every time I think about resurrection. I remember he was a really good kid, kind, made the rest of us look really bad, but I never got to know him. He wasn't around long enough for us to play together, to study together, to sleep over and share secrets in the dark. We never got to compare careers or go on vacations or wink at an inside joke. So I'm looking forward to making up for lost time, hugging him, talking to him, getting to know him, and collecting life experiences that we never had in this life. And we will be able to, because we will both have a body to make life possible. So a moment for you to begin a conversation with God, and then a little Malcolm Guite. Also for this morning is Psalm 37. This is Malcolm Guite. I'll fret no more for passing wickedness, no more than for the new mown grass that fades to leave room for the growth and tenderness of fresh green leaves. The cool, inviting glades of my new life in you, my heart's desire. The true sun rises now, and soon the shades, the last black shades of night, will back retire and mix no more with good. Then I will sing the song of my redemption in that choir where I, whom you have made, at last can bring my song to its beginning and its end. Till then, I'll be content with each small thing your love provides, and let the rich contend with one another for their fading wealth. For I have found my God and my true friend. Amen.